This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Mr. Zuckerberg, I remember well your first visit to Capitol Hill back in 2010. You spoke to the Senate Republican High-Tech Task Force, which I chair. You said back then that Facebook would always be free. Is that still your objective?
Senator, yes. There will always be a version of Facebook that is free. It is our mission to try to help connect everyone around the world and to bring the world closer together. In order to do that, we believe that we need to offer a service that everyone can afford, and we're committed to doing that.
Well, if so, how do you sustain a business model in which users don't pay for your service?
Senator, we run ads.
Oh my God, it's a jungle in here. You've got wild animals loose in here.
Welcome to Ring True, a mini-series on the psychology, politics, and business model behind the spread of misinformation in science news. Over the course of 6 episodes, we'll be discovering the history and evolution of misinformation, both in the physical and digital spaces. You'll also meet the heroes and villains of the post-truth era, and hopefully find your place as you navigate a world of eroding trust and accountability. I'm Caroline Oh, and this week we'll pick up where we left off, social warming and how it stands on the shoulders of tech giants. The camera doesn't lie. Of course, this phrase was coined after the mid-19th century, when printed photographs became available to the masses. Then, in 1990, there was Photoshop, and along with it, image manipulation. And that changed everything. Skip forward to 2017, and we first heard the term deepfake. That's a technique for audiovisual synthesis using artificial intelligence. Now, if we can no longer believe every image and all the footage that we see, have we truly entered the post-truth era? Last week, we heard from tech journalist and author Charles Arthur about social warming.
Okay, so I have a sort of working hypothesis or a theory, which is that we are seeing, with the spread of smartphones and social networks and people being connected all the time, that we're seeing something rather like we had with global warming, where internal combustion engines, gigantic power companies burning fossil fuels led to the warming of the atmosphere. With smartphones and social networks, we're seeing a sort of warming of society, social warming. We're seeing effects where things are being speeded up, where people are responding in ways that they wouldn't have before, because we're changing the climate of society. We're changing the sort of world that we live in. Just as we're changing the atmosphere by putting more carbon dioxide into it, we're changing the way society functions by putting more information into it, by getting people to respond quicker. Politicians are on Twitter all the time. Politicians are on Facebook. People are sharing fake news, real news. It's all happening so much faster than it ever happened before. And that's radically altering the way that our society functions.
To truly appreciate the social warming that's happening, we need to go back in time, way back to the 15th century. from syllabaries to alphabets. At that point in time, we had developed mature writing systems across the world. But it wasn't until 1440 in Germany when the printing press was invented by a Johannes Gutenberg. The printing press was a machine that was able to transfer ink to paper. Before that, books were handwritten. That's right, every single copy. It took a lot of time and effort and, of course, money. It was expensive, and only the rich and powerful could afford it. But the printing press was revolutionary. It allowed the mass production of books and also other documents. By the 17th century, it spurred information sharing, making it one of the earliest and most influential steps to the democratization of knowledge. Fast forward to the 20th century. The internet became accessible to the general public in the late 80s. There was great hope that it would strengthen democracy. Like the printing press, the internet has produced an explosion of accessible material. Now, with its incredible ease, speed, and low cost, this explosion of information caused concerns about accuracy and credibility. And rather than taking two centuries, like the printing revolution, the democratization of technology happened in less than three decades. Today, more than half of the entire population has internet access.
So all the big social networks use algorithms to try to drive people to spend more time on them. The reason why they do that is because the more time people spend on a social network, the more likely they are to see an ad. The social networks make their money from ads. So the more time you spend on social network A is less time on social network B. That means social network A shows more ads, gets more money, it gets bigger. For them, it's a virtuous circle.
Big tech companies incentivize higher engagement to collect and provide as much data about their users to advertisers. So what happens when the likes of Amazon, Apple, Facebook or Google know about us and our interests? Well, we receive ads and postings that apparently accurately reflect our interests. And when we see things we like, it maximizes the time that we spend on their sites. A passive selective exposure. A nudge to our behavior. It's a virtual cycle.
The rules for content going viral seem to be that if it is something which causes outrage, that will spread far more quickly than the truth. Though, obviously, if something is true and outrageous, then that'll also spread. It has to be smartphone-sized because the content these days is almost always viewed on social networks on phones. For Facebook, it's overwhelmingly on your phone. So it has to be something that's comparatively small, that's electronic, that's easy to share in that way. Something which has a visual is going to attract more attention. It will interest people more quickly. And something which engages the emotions generally is going to be far more effective than something which is very rationally based. Timing tends to make a difference, but it's impossible to predict before it goes viral whether it's going to work. You can only see these things in retrospect. So in general, yeah, it's outrage tends to get ahead of truth.
Content sharing platforms such as Twitter, Facebook and YouTube also use deep learning algorithms to prioritize popular content. Now that's because users are more likely to stick around if they see content that has already a lot of retweets and mentions. So even if your Twitter profile says retweet does not mean endorsement, you're already doing the work for big tech. As long as enough of us react to a post, the newsfeed algorithm shows it to more users. It taps into their biases, prompting even more engagement and so on. It creates a cycle, a confirmation bias machine.
But driving people to spend more time on a social network doesn't correlate with them having accurate information. Things that you engage with may be things that outrage you, but it doesn't mean that they're true. There's no mechanism for an algorithm to determine the truth of something. It just looks at whether people spend a long time looking at it. So in that sense, you have a perverse incentive that things which are untrue may actually be something that people spend the most time engaging with.
There's also your filter bubble. Now, you can do a little exercise. Open your browser, use your default search engine, and look up, say, vaccination. Then select 10 family members, colleagues, and friends. Get them to do the same. Your search queries may yield very different results depending on your prior online activities.
We've seen cases where people have been radicalized through YouTube, for example, because its algorithm was tweaked a few years ago to make people spend more time. And that has led them down the rabbit holes of extreme right, far right videos, flat earth videos, things that aren't true, but which they find engaging. And that's the difficulty. If we were being told that these algorithms were being driven by aliens, then we'd declare war on the aliens, I think. But because they're all built by engineers in big tech companies, we think that they must be fine.
So the truth has a habit of being boring, even a little dull. However, conspiracies are exciting. And as we know, rumors and conspiracy theories have long been around. So what's the difference if they occupy the online social network? Well, in 2016, The Guardian investigated and found that a group of North Macedonian teens were responsible for much of the disinformation surrounding the 2016 US presidential elections. The teens actually made up to several thousand dollars a day, and this was in a town where the average salary was several thousand dollars a month. And they would earn just as much, irrespective of who won the election. In fact, prior to the 2016 election, they gained revenue from fake medical advice sites. Now, here is Hugo Leal of the University of Cambridge explaining.
Think of a rumor, for example. A society is basically a social network. So a rumor would travel as far as your social network would reach, okay? 200 years ago, it was rather limited to your friends, family, and the social sphere would be rather limited. Today, the reach has been amplified. So a local rumor, falsehood, conspiracy theory, can become global in a matter of seconds. So this is what changed. The reach of our social networks has increased exponentially. On top of that, there is the fact that these theories, as I said earlier, are being appropriated for political and economic purposes. Even though they are not the classical conspiracy theories, for example, when you think of the moon landing or the Illuminati, we need to separate conspiracy theories between those which do not lend themselves to political appropriation, the classical ones, and the others who actually do and are being appropriated.
The influence of big tech is everywhere. Now think about it. Google runs not just the most used search engine, but also the most used internet browser, Chrome, also the Android operating system. Facebook owns Instagram and WhatsApp. And then there's Amazon.
My name is Alexa, and I'm here to say, I'm the baddest AI in the cloud today.
Apple, Microsoft, they're all big and powerful. So what can we do about it? Well, Jack S.M. Key works on internet rights. And in 2016, she spoke with BFM about what she does.
I am acutely aware of the structures of power behind some of the technology platforms that we're using. So, for example, I am very against Facebook, in terms of how we invest more and more of ourselves into this platform, where it's become, to some people, the internet is Facebook, which is a huge shame, because the internet is a wonderful space full of many, many things. But because we spend so much of our time in this one little space, it's like we think the whole world is just one big blue mall, right? So as such, I'm not on Facebook. I make very conscious feminist political decisions on which online spaces to engage with. I'm reluctantly engaging with Google because but as much as possible, I try not to use Google as my default search engine because that also sort of limits and constrains what I'm looking for within particular Google algorithmic pieces. But I am on Twitter because I think out of many different social media platforms, that's the one that still doesn't try to shunt me into particular bubbles quite so much. I still have some level of autonomy lah, to decide what I want to see or don't want to see. So it's a complicated. So I engage really with technology on various layers. Yeah, from the layer of access and infrastructure itself to the layer of software development and control, and what are the different kinds of ways in which we organize even the field, no? Like how the field is being organized, to the kinds of software that we develop, to the values that are imbued within it, to the level of policy and law and decision making, to the level of practice. So how do we engage with the digital culture? So it's really at this kind of fanned out way.
So does that mean that we should all do the same? Or perhaps the better question is, are we capable of doing the same?
I think we live in a very incredible age, actually. We are living in an age where technology is sort of being, well, digital technologies are transforming the way in which we understand power relations, in which we understand how we exist as individuals within a society, how we understand economy, social relations, culture, politics, and so on. And it's sort of unfolding as we are living day to day. So it's almost like being in the moment where the printing press is being invented, no? And how that has really transformed the way in which monopoly of knowledge happened. So we are in this age right now, and we have the capacity to actually influence and inform and shape how this is going to look like.
And exactly how are we going to do that? In the next episode, we'll explore what shapes public opinions and whether the role of fact checkers is indeed relevant. And now for our words of the week. Traditional media, new media, and synthetic media. Traditional media, also referred to as old media. Traditional media encompasses television, newspaper, radio, and magazines. New media, also known as digital media. New media refers to online sites and streaming services. Synthetic media. Synthetic media is used to describe created or modified media, including deepfake and other AI-manipulated content. And that's it from us this week. You've been listening to Ring True, a six-part mini-series on the psychology, politics, and business model behind the spread of misinformation in science news. I'm Caroline Oh. This is BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.